Security should be an enabler. Let's start with that, right? We're not the department of no. But traditionally, we've said no to a lot of different things, right? Everything needs to be in business terms. It's really important for security professionals to understand the business acumen of the organization they're supporting. Part of that is understanding how your company makes money. If you can get a third grader to understand it, then you're in good shape. Offshoring doesn't mean that we offload responsibility. What it does mean is that we have additional employees, or our teams are extended past our shores. So when I look at the role of a CISO and the security team, we're first responders. The same way as a firefighter or a police officer. We respond to an incident, right? Trying to figure out exactly what's happening, triaging that incident, and then, you know, jumping in to try to contain something. Be brilliant at the basics. And what that means is that when companies invest in cybersecurity foundational controls and getting them in place, man, they're able to withstand so many different types of attacks.
What does it take to secure the world's most iconic brands? Our guest today knows better than anyone. Nicole Darden Ford is the Vice President of the Customer Security Officer Program at Microsoft, a role that places her at the intersection of global security strategy and customer success for the world's leading cloud and AI provider. Nicole's journey to Microsoft is marked by a series of firsts and massive transformations. She has guided organizations like Nordstrom, Rockwell Automation, and Baxter International through critical security evolutions and IPOs. Her foundation was built in the federal government and the military, giving her a unique, battle-tested perspective on risk. She is a sought-after board member, a mentor for the next generation of tech leaders, and a true visionary in the field. We are honored to have her with us to discuss the future of security at scale. And without further ado, Nicole, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us here today, Nicole. So just real briefly before we get into the whole spiel of our show, a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I am Nicole Ford. I am currently working at Microsoft as a vice president and head of the chief security advisor organization within Microsoft. Prior to that, I was a five-time CISO. So CISO at like Nordstrom, Rockwell, Baxter Healthcare, Carrier Global Corporation, to name a few. I have a background in technology, but also cybersecurity. I also spent time working in the federal government as well as the Department of Defense.
Perfect, perfect. Before we get into the cool questions, when you say like your background in cyber, like when you are, I guess, like a individual contributor or a middle manager, as they call them, I guess, what domain were you working in?
Oh, wow. So in cybersecurity, I did everything you can think about. Like starting early in my career, I was in charge of all facets of cyber. So let me kind of set the stage for you. Okay. When I went into the field, it was technology. It wasn't cybersecurity. So as a result of that, there weren't specific disciplines that you can go and specialize in. So my first assignment was to create a cybersecurity program from scratch. So as a result of that, I really worked on creating the disciplines holistically, right? And then drilling down into each of them. I would certainly say that I spent a lot of time in governance, risk, and compliance, security operations as well. Third-party risk was a favorite of mine. I started my career as an enterprise architect, so obviously architecture and engineering was a passion and a strength for me. So security architecture and engineering as well. So when you kind of think about all of the different disciplines, I've been able to cover all of them throughout my career. And even as a middle manager, that was a strength of mine. Number one, to be able to build programs from scratch. And then number two, to actually implement and execute on those programs, right? And to be able to go deep in a specific discipline, right? Go wide and deep was something that I prided myself in as well.
Perfect, perfect. And I ask that too because a lot of times, as you probably experienced this in the past, sometimes we have people who we report up to who possibly have never did the thing that we do.
Yes.
And a lot of times there's a lot of disconnect between those two based on whatever the vision or the strategy that they have for the company versus maybe what actually works, what you currently have in the org. And kind of like sometimes there's no meeting in the middle with that. And so you often hear that a lot. So this person don't know what they're doing. All they did was they went to school and got their MBA and they made them a C-level person or whatever, all those type of things.
No, I think that's an important distinction, right? So for me, I was a practitioner so that I didn't come from, let's go get a degree in cybersecurity. And then I became a manager and now I'm leading cyber professionals. Like I was a practitioner, right? I really prided myself in learning the technologies, understanding them, and then to be able to implement them. So a part of my learning and my desire to be a continuous learner was to actually teach. So I actually taught courses, right? And that helped me to learn the technologies. If you can teach somebody, right, you can do it. So that was a really helpful way for me to learn the technologies and then apply those technologies. And then obviously, once you understand those technologies to be able to lead and manage people, you have an understanding and empathy for the work that they do because I was a practitioner.
Man, that's awesome. That's awesome. Now, very quickly too, with your latest role, can you sum that up to us at a high level?
Yeah, absolutely. Working for Microsoft, one of the largest technology companies in the world, we have an opportunity to touch so many organizations. And so my job is to build credibility and trust on behalf of Microsoft with our customers, which I think is a very important role when you think about the communities we serve, specifically the CXO communities in general, that's all C-suite. We call them the rooms of the house, but also specifically the CISO community is what my team does. We build and develop trust and credibility with that community and really help them to understand Microsoft, internal to Microsoft, and really to get the most value out of the relationship with us as an organization.
Now let's get into the fun stuff. So security has historically had a reputation as the department where good ideas go to die because of the compliance hurdles. How do you shift the culture of an organization so that employees see the security team as a business enabler rather than a handbrake on innovation?
I love that question. So first of all, security should be an enabler. Let's start with that, right? We're not the department of no. But traditionally, we've said no to a lot of different things, right? So when we come to the table, I think one of the most important things that I did when I was the CISO was to really focus on how do we sit side by side with our business counterparts to understand what they want to do. And then how do we enable that solution to occur, right? So again, it's more like, let's sit at the table with you, figure out what you're trying to do, and then offer you solutions on how to get it done. I think generally, people want to see an outcome. And in order to get to that outcome, we have to be almost like solution engineers, figuring out how do we make that solution happen, or how do we make that outcome happen for our business counterparts so that they can do their job? Because ultimately, companies are here to drive revenue, right? We know that for a fact. So our opportunity to really help them be a part of that innovation curve is really important. So I tell my teams specifically, we're here not to say no, but to enable them. So how do we say yes? Let's find a solution that allows us to say yes, but still protect and defend this organization that we're serving.
I like that you said, how do we say yes? Because I think that is an easy way to disarm anybody who is in the meeting thinking that they have a preconceived notion that, no, we can't do this. And I think that's what most people do. I can't remember if we talked about this the time that we talked a couple of weeks ago, but like insecurity is so siloed, and then take outside of that to where it is silo from other orgs and to where there's just a big misconception of, like you said, the department of no. Whereas most of the time we want you to do whatever you want to do to help the company make money. We just want to be safe at it so we don't end up spending more money either fixing vulnerabilities or the potential of us having a crazy type of breach. And I think a lot of times, even when it comes to building products and everything else, the security of it is on the back burner because, like you said, profits. I think I recently did an episode, I think I recorded it, what was that, Sunday? And I was talking about how some companies chose, I think, was it profits over privacy? No, I think I said profits over protection. I think that's what I said. And I was just saying, like, I think both can be done, because especially now, I think technology has advanced far enough where it doesn't always have to be no. There are definitely a lot of, what's the word I want to look for? Granular things that you can do security-wise to enable the company to keep making money.
Yeah, like technology has matured, right? There's no reason for us to say no. We have more innovative ways to defend and protect companies or to secure them. So the reality is, the question we should be asking is, how do we say yes? And what do we put in place in order to make that yes a reality? And that's what I think has to change. The other piece is really making sure that people understand that this is, everybody is a security professional, no matter where you are in the organization. So we should always have our security hat on and figure out, like, listen, I want to go do X. How do I do this in the most secure way, right? So it's also about changing the culture of the organization so that it's a security first mindset. And that security first mindset extends to everyone, and they understand what they're here to do. And when you do that, they start thinking about, okay, great, I want to go do X. How do I do it in the most secure way, right? So everybody puts on their security hat and they engage in the security conversation. And that's when you know the culture has changed. And that shift is there to not just support the organization, but really to support this security first mindset that not only the security team has, but everybody in their work.
Now, how do you explain deeply technical cyber risks into clear financial metrics that CEO of a board of members can actually act on and understand?
So remember, everything needs to be in business terms. It's really important for security professionals to understand the business acumen of the organization they're supporting. Part of that is understanding how your company makes money, right? And starting to understand the acronyms, the nomenclature they're using, the business speak that they are speaking in meetings, right? When you understand that and you understand what's most important to the company, you need to make sure that you're tailoring your security message to align with that, right? Organizational alignment matters, right? And so security, we're not doing security for security's sake. We're doing it because we're trying to protect an organization that has a mission to do X, Y, or Z, healthcare, retail, you name it. They're out there to support something or to provide a product that supports something. So understanding the lingo matters. Understanding what's important to that company matters. And then making sure that your metrics align to that. So if you're in a manufacturing organization, when you talk to the CEO, the board, you're going to talk about making sure that that manufacturing line or that set of manufacturing lines are up and running, right? Because we're trying to generate product. And so the name of the game for them is that is uptime, right? The more uptime I have, the more I can create products, right? The more I can get them out to the market and I can make money because I can sell them. So making sure that I am speaking in terms that that matter, that, you know, when we talk about the amount of money that it costs when we're down, how much does downtime cost, right? And when I can speak to them in that language, or, and I can apply it to risk, right? So if in fact we have a ransomware attack and that ransomware attack impacts that line and stops that line, then I have downtime. And there's a quantification for that downtime, right? So ransomware is a risk for that manufacturing company, right? So I need to speak in those terms so that they understand that if a line goes down because of a ransomware attack, this is the impact to the organization, right? And when I can actually relay that information in dollars and cents, it's easier for the business leaders to understand exactly what would occur if we had a cyber attack. So using those terms and simplifying your language is very important. And recognizing that not everybody's as techy as you, right? They don't know the nomenclature, nor do they care. What they care about is their ability to do business in the most effective and the most efficient way, and your ability to really tie in how cyber impacts that. And what you need to do to really support them is super important. And remember something, and I always say this, if you can get a third grader to understand it, then you're in good shape.
Yeah, I agree that. And I thought about something that wasn't on the list. And it's one of the things now that a lot of people, at least U.S. side, are worrying about when it comes to cybersecurity. And it comes about with the offshoring of cybersecurity to people overseas, to where most times, I'm just going to be honest here, the level of service that is given on that end is not the same, and it's much cheaper. I'm going to try to phrase it like this. Have you ever had to deal with either pushing for offshoring from a business standpoint or pushing against it from a business standpoint of what possibly could happen on the knowledge gaps and what you currently already have versus just trying to save money, increase profits, and show stakeholders how we're doing?
So, yes, of course. So I've been a CISO of several Fortune 500 companies that are global. So, of course, we're always talking about offshoring, kind of onshoring, nearshoring, and the benefits and the pros and cons. I think what I typically say is there's always a benefit and a disadvantage of doing it, right? But I think what has to happen is when the company decides to offshore, they really need to make sure that they get the culture right, right? And one of the things I think is most important is that offshoring doesn't mean that we offload responsibility. What it does mean is that we have additional employees, or our teams are extended past our shores. It means that we need to spend a little bit more time helping the offshore employees understand the culture of the organization, what we do, and what's most important to us, right? So that we can get the best out of them. Making sure they're an extension of the team always is a recipe for success. So not treating them like they're a third party or they're another group, but really bringing them into the organization in a way that helps them understand and setting the context of what we do and really setting a set of ground rules, right? And developing a culture where we're super connected is recipe for success. When we don't do that and we throw things over the fence, we have challenges because they don't quite understand the culture. They don't understand what we're trying to do. They don't understand our core principles, things that are most important to us, like customer service and responsiveness and all of the things that could be lost in translation. We also need to think about the language barriers and what the challenges around language really is and how do we solve for that, right? So I think it's important to set up the right structure to make sure that we have team members that are working directly with the offshore team so that they can get their questions answered quickly, so that there's no ambiguity and there's clarity in how this relationship works. And so it does take a lot. I've actually built several functions. Offshore, onshore, nearshore, you name it. I've done all of it. So yeah, I do think that most of the time when companies just throw things over the fence and they're only focused on cutting cost and really speed, then that causes some other challenges that they end up having to solve for, because culture and belonging and inclusiveness and making sure that they understand what we're trying to do are all kind of the keys to success in those relationships.
Yeah, I agree. I would believe it's worked best in mature organizations versus immature ones that don't really have their policies and everything set up. So now you have these people who don't even have the knowledge of what's in the network, what's going on, processes, procedures, how the business makes money. It definitely does make it very tiresome. So I've seen both. I've seen where it could be good. I've seen where it's lackluster, at least from the operations side and working in SecOps and IR. So I think there's a good mix when both teams at least are, I'm not going to say always intertwined, because sometimes, like, you know, your day team, most of the time is not interacting with those guys unless, like, they're working besides them and shift handovers, trying to structure other things just so they can talk to each other a little bit. That way, everybody can learn something from each other. I'll just say that, too. They know things, put it together and work it out.
I think hybrid situations work best. I think you alluded to that, right? When you talk about intertwining the teams, it's mm-hmm. really those hybrid situations where you have onshore, offshore resources working together, right? And that whole process of putting people in pods, I try to do that as well, right? I force people to work together and share knowledge because I know that's a key to success, but also it helps with people understanding each other, especially when times get really tough, when we're working on incidents. That's not the time for us to try to figure out how to work together. We need to do that ahead of those incidents during peacetime.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, a couple of weeks ago, we had our on-site and a couple of our analysts from overseas actually joined us. So we got to meet them for the first time in person versus only talking to them in Teams messages. So thought that was pretty good for both sides to get the bun with us, see the U.S. culture, and based on whatever they heard about it versus what they see. So I thought that was pretty cool as well. Now, on LinkedIn, we see a lot with CISO burnout. And I know it's a massive topic in the industry right now, with many feeling they're constantly one bad click away from a career-ending breach. How do you protect your own mental health and the mental health of your team in a role where the stakes are always on high alert?
That's a great question. So first of all, we're not always on high alert, right? We have peacetime. So you'll hear me say the word peacetime, which means this is like that downtime that you need. I think it's really important to kind of protect your peace, right? You probably have heard people say, I protect my peace, right?
Right.
And setting some boundaries is really important as a CISO, right? I think it's important to really make sure you have time away from the job. And that means that you have thought through your succession planning, right? So making sure that you have a deputy or somebody who can sub in and give you some time to actually go on a vacation, a real vacation, not something where you have your phone next to you, yep. Your phone is next to your bed, and you're answering the call. A real vacation where you can unplug and really spend time with your family or doing something you love, but that you're truly away is very important. And so let me kind of talk about a few things that I think are really important. So when I look at the role of a CISO and the security team, we're first responders, the same way as a firefighter, right? Or a police officer. We respond to an incident, right? Trying to figure out exactly what's happening, triaging that incident, and then, you know, jumping in to try to contain something. So that's a first responder. And so when you think about it, every time you have a breach, that's like trauma, right? Think about it. It's like a trauma event for you. And so we start to kind of react like we have PTSD as a result of that. So I think it's really important that teams set boundaries and make sure that people are getting adequate time off, that they're talking about how they feel, right? That when you go through your lessons learned after an incident, you really need to spend some time sharing feelings, not just what happened or what we're not going to do next time, but how did it make you feel? Like, what were some things that were really stressful for you as a part of that? And really speaking to that, because I think it's important to do that. I think it's also important to, you know, do tabletops and drills, right? So that you can get through those situations in the most efficient way possible. And the more we learn and the more we can, you know, drill and really go through that process and kind of understand, like, how do I get through that process in the most efficient way, I think is important as well, right? So that's a key. I do think, again, going back to time off, it's really important. So taking the time off, going to do something fun, doing something you love, I think gives you an opportunity to unplug in a way that really helps to recharge your battery. And that's really important. And so CISOs are always fighting to get more people so that they can give valuable people an opportunity to unplug. And so I think we continue to do that. We continue to make sure that we have a bench of one, two, and three, right? We always need to have a first, second, third, so that we have enough rotation in our team members so that they're getting a break. And I think you got to care about your people, right? And what that burnout looks like and helping to see the danger signs of when somebody's burnt out or getting there and have a plan for how to help them right through that process, right? I don't think everybody's fit to be on the front lines. I think that there are other roles sometimes that people can take. And I do believe job rotation is a very helpful way to spread the challenges, right? Spread the love a little bit and give people some time to do something different. Even if they love this, even if it's like the thing they do and it makes their day, right? Rotating them to do something different every once in a while kind of helps them recharge their battery so that they can live to fight another breach. And I think that is super important. The other thing from a CISO perspective is making sure that CISOs have done all the work to feel protected, right? Whether that is making sure that they have the right employment agreements. I mean, all of this is a real conversation, right? Making sure that they know what will happen if there is a breach, right? Making sure that they have put all the right processes in place so that their team, there are people who are going to come in and support an incident when it happens. All of that kind of factors into this burnout that we see quite often. And the fact that now, as a result of that, CISOs are only lasting what I think the average tenure is 18 to 24 months as a result. We want to see that increase because CISOs are not feeling like they're the scapegoat or that they're being sacrificed as a result of a bad breach, right? So we're seeing the market change slightly where organizations kind of understand that, like, it's not just a security team's responsibility to fight cyber incidents, that it's really jointly everybody in the organization that should lend a hand and really support that. The jury's out on as to whether that will continue to change, but I think it's mature CISOs know how to create the right environment that really reduces the amount of burnout for themselves as well as their team.
Perfect. And so you touched on a lot. One thing I want to say is like if you probably don't know this, and the viewers, some of them know this, but I have a big family back home from Shreveport, and a lot of them are first responders. They're firemen, EMTs. I had an uncle that was a fire chief. And so the example that you use is an example I've used plenty of times in interviews when it comes to incident response of just being like a policeman, detective, EMT, fireman, going to the scene, like you said, to contain and scope out whatever the incident is. So I definitely like that you said that. And then the other thing that actually caught my attention that I've always wondered, and this would be based on what you want to share, not trying to pry too much, but like you said, I think you said the average tenure of CISOs is between, I think, 18 and 24 months. That's what you said, right?
Yes.
Okay. I've always wondered this because, granted, once you're a C-level, I know that the compensation is different, but when CISOs are either maybe laid off versus or fired or however it goes, are the structures similar to like athletes or anything? Like, you know, for example, an athlete, like, whatever happens, but they're on contract. So something happened, but they still got to get paid because the contract says, hey, you pay them no matter what's happening, $3 million on June 7th if they're still on the team. Is that how it works once you get to the C levels where it's less likely on the lower level, depending on the company, you may get 4 or 5 months severance or whatever. But I know that C levels compensation is vastly different from us little guys.
Yeah, so each organization is a little different, but as CISOs, you know, we often talk about having employment agreements in place. So when something has to happen or there has to be a separation, that you are protected, right? Same as an athlete. Like, listen, up front, this is what you're going to have to pay in order for anything to go down. And so the reality is that it differs across the industries, and each organization does something a little different. But it is important for CISOs to kind of define those outcomes ahead of time so that they know exactly what should happen should anything happen. Again, we're still really early in the evolution of the CISO, but it's something we're really focused on is how are CISOs taken care of, just like other C-suite executives? And you're right. I mean, those things are they're negotiated up front so that the CISO is protected throughout its life cycle within an organization.
Now, this is a separate question. It's not really on CISOs, but it's really about just the regular American worker. And this is non-union related, but do you ever see them putting something into legislature that makes employees have a little bit more protection, or at least puts companies a little bit more on the hook? Because, for example, I don't care what anybody says, in 2026, you're giving a person one check or two checks, it's not a severance, especially with the way hiring is going and inflation and everything else on how long the average time it takes to get another job. Do you see them doing anything like that? Because I do not think that, and I could be wrong, I'm going to have to look this up afterwards, but I know for a fact, like in Europe, I think they have some protections over what happens when people get laid off or fired, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so I really can't speak to legislation or if there's anything happening at this point. I will say that there are, countries that have more generous policies mm-hmm. that protect employees versus the company. I think, the United States, we protect companies more than we protect employees. And so, yeah, I'd love to see that paradigm shift. Not sure that that's going to happen. And again, these are my views, not the views of Microsoft in general. But in general, I think we could always use additional protections. I think that there's some challenges right now because, everybody's talking about AI, that AI is going to displace people. When in fact, hopefully that's not the case across organizations, that they really look at AI as a way to augment specific functions in support of employees, right? I think human in the loop matters. And I think in general, we want to restructure or reskill employees so that they can meet the moment and be a part of this evolution that we find ourselves in.
Definitely. Yeah, I definitely just talked about that. I had a talk with Profit Security, and we were talking about AI, and we were talking about human in the loop, and why it's not the end all be all of security operations and how it's there to enable SecOps.
Exactly.
Now, because we'll get into some AI talk in a bit, I want to go back to one more thing, because you brought up incident response, right? This is a question, but I'm trying to word it a different way. But it says, walk us through the first 60 minutes of your worst day when an alert rings that indicates a major incident. What are the very first decisions you have to make? And I guess this is pretty cool because most times on YouTube, we see the incident responder, what they say they're doing, where they're setting up a bridge call and doing all this cool stuff or whatever. But as high up as you are, what does that look like on your end?
So you're saying the first 60 minutes. I would certainly say, of course, I've gotten a call. The first thing I'm doing is listening to the person on the line kind of tell me what's happening, right? So, of course, I'm trying to get the who, what, where, why, and when. What's going on? Do we have an understanding of scope and impact, right? Who's involved? And my first thing is, who do I need to contact, right? If you go back to, a standard incident response process is trying to do what I call a damage assessment. And that's, what do we see? What's happened and what's the impact of that? Is there a scope, right? Depending on what type of company I'm a part of, is there a regulatory requirement for me to report? If there is, what are those numbers look like? And so where am I in that on that spectrum as well? So it's what's happening? Who am I going to contact within the organization to inform them that we have something going on? And then what regulatory requirements do I need to take into account as I'm assessing the situation? That's what my first 60 minutes is, which is really listening and it's assessing where we are. It's taking in a lot of feedback from my team, and then it's responding back to leadership to let them know where we are, what's happening, and what we need from them in order to address the situation.
But generative AI is changing the game for defenders, but it's also supercharging the bad actors, allowing them to create hyper-realistic deepfakes and automated malware. Who's winning the AR arms race, the hackers or the defenders? That's what I view it as. I don't view it as like just putting it solely on seesaws, like they're there with a shield and a sword going against them.
Seesaws are like the generals. So right. About like an army, seesaws are generals, right? But there are all these people who have specific disciplines, right? Like security ops that feed into the decisions that general needs to make. So it is defenders versus attackers, right? That's the real concern. And so you have to really kind of think about this, that the big concern here is that this is a way of life. And this is a way that attackers make money. Imagine that you go to work every day as in your role. And so you're there because you want to make a living for you and your family. The attackers are doing the same thing. And they're putting the same amount of effort and rigor into getting that done every day that you are when you think about going into the office. So the reason why I bring this up is because I think that there's challenges on both sides. I'm as a first responder, I feel like every day that we go into our organization and they can continue to make money, we win, right? It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be some casualties along the way. It doesn't mean that they're not going to get a win here, a win there, a win here, a win there. But I think overall, the biggest losers are not even the defenders and the attackers. It's the people that are the losers. Everybody else is an actor in the show when you think about it. The attackers have to make a living. They've chosen to make a living in cybercrime. Are they doing that? Yes. They're continuing to come up with attacks that are sophisticated. Some of them are not. Some of them are like, hey, listen, we don't even need to come up with sophisticated attacks. We can just do basics, right? Because people aren't doing foundational work right now.
Right.
And then if you think about it, the defenders with AI are really catching up to attackers in some ways, right? Because now we are getting the opportunity to really dig into areas we've been talking about for years, and that's automation. Now, AI helps us realize automation in ways we have not been able to achieve. And that, I think, is where we're going to see a big, like, sea change between defenders and attackers. Of course, everybody now has AI as a secret weapon. And that secret weapon is really going to cause the speed to continue to increase, where we're going to see sophisticated attacks, but we're also going to see agents that can address those attacks fairly quickly. What I think it's going to do is it's going to cause defenders to have to trust these technologies a little bit more than we have in the past. We trust people, but we don't always trust the technology. But now we got to trust the technology a little bit more because the speed and the scale of the attacks are going to increase. And so it's forcing some changes in the industry. Some are really good changes that we're going to adopt as a result. So yeah. I know I can answer the question. Who's the loser? Who loses? I don't think we lose. I think we just continue to get better or elevate our game as a result. And so I don't think we're at a point where anybody wins or loses except for the people in the middle, which are the citizens of the world.
Yeah, I think that, like you said, I think it's going to shift more off of the capabilities of these tools, and just really they're going to keep on doing what they've been doing. Like you said, the basics, preying on human emotion and ignorance. Because when it comes to, when I think about the deepfake stuff, so many execs have their voices and likeness out there. So now they can clone these things and try to make them look as real as they can. And so it's going to be on a different, like a new way of security awareness. There should be certain passcodes or things that maybe execs come up with or their executive support team have. That way they can know, hey, this didn't come from, this is a deepfake. This is phishing. This isn't them.
So this is back to code words, right? Let's go back some old school kind of, you know, intelligence things that we did back in the day, right? So what's the code word, right? And actually in their sayings that we could, you know, if I say something, I say it every time I actually record a video or there's a code word or something encoded in the conversation, I think we're going to get to some of those things where it's something you know, and it's uniquely something that you know that no one else knows.
Yeah. And like something, I'll point out something very minuscule that people don't pay attention to. I've been in a couple of incidents where I've seen like an email chain get hijacked from an attacker and they have a typo squatted domain stood up. One thing you notice is the attacker a lot of times does not take the time to use the same signature that everyone in the company uses, which sometimes can be a signifier that, I don't know if this is the right person because this is their typical signature. What's up with their signature? And so as small as it is, that's a little detail that I've seen sometimes, them not doing that. They're just trying to go straight to whoever handles the money information and get some money over to their company.
But those are the little details, right? Think about what you're saying, right? So the little details are what really separates defenders from attackers, right? Attackers aren't going to know all the little details. They're going to know what's publicly available about people. They're going to know things that other people know, not necessarily things that people don't know about things. And they're not going to, remember, it's all about speed. So of course, attention to detail matters, but in instances like this, their attention to detail still is a little off when you think about it, right? They may get 85% of it, but there's always going to be a small percentage of things that are still wrong, and we have to be able to spot them. So people who are good at puzzles and pointing out discrepancies will be the winners when it comes to stuff like this.
Right. And if I have any young ones watching this, those of you that like to play the action adventure video games where we got to solve these puzzles and get to the next place and find stuff. Yeah. It comes in handy. Now, this is a cool question because you actually kind of brought a little bit of this up. But it says, if you look back 10 or 15 years ago, the CISO was basically a glorified IT manager hidden away in the server room. Today, you're a core business strategist. How has the baseline definition of what makes a successful CISO changed over the last decade?
So let me say this, right? So there are different types of CISOs, and I do a training on, you know, these CISO archetypes and helping people understand the differences, right? There's a CISO that's more of a technical CISO. Then you have a business-focused CISO. They may have come out of the business. You know, then you have somebody who has an audit and compliance background, right? And so they are a different type of CISO as well. And there's several other archetypes as well. So yeah, you see people with different backgrounds coming into this role. And I think the most important thing that I would certainly say in where we see the evolution is their ability to understand their business, their ability to speak to business people, or business leaders within the organization, and their ability to take really complex things and make them simple to understand is the key to really being successful. So we see that there are some CISOs, and you're right. We all kind of, when you think about it, CISOs started from technical backgrounds and became CISOs. So they had to learn how to speak a whole new language in order to really communicate with leaders within the organizations. And there was a need to have to do that, right? To communicate and to get the budget necessary, right? Help people understand the risk associated with some cybersecurity, with your program in general, and some of the issues that were happening in the attacks. All of that is really important. And what is based on the different types of organizations out there in the different industries, they require different types of CISOs. And so it's incumbent upon people to understand like what type of CISO is necessary for a specific CISO job, and do I have those skills? If I don't, then I need to go and develop those skills. I need to be able to speak the right risk language. I need to be able to speak the business language. I need to be able to understand the technical aspects of the organization or the ecosystem that I'm supporting, and to be able to speak to the technical people, right, and liaise with them on what they need to do to solve problems. And so we've seen the skill set expand and increase over time. And so now the difference is back in the day, you could be a technical CISO and do well. Today, that technical CISO also has to have additional business skills and risk language, as well as the ability to understand how that company makes money and the nuances of that company in order to be successful.
Yeah, I agree. Now, here's a cool one. If you could put a single piece of cybersecurity advice on a billboard outside of every major corporate office building in the world, what would it say?
That is a good question. I think that's a fun question, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say invest in the basics, right? So it's great to do all of these very mature cybersecurity techniques and principles and solutions. That's great. But if you're not doing the basics right, like you have to do those well, right? You have to be brilliant at the basics. And when you do that, and that's probably what I would say, be brilliant at the basics. And what that means is that when companies invest in cybersecurity foundational controls and getting them in place, man, they're able to withstand so many different types of attacks, right? So, you know, really investing in those basic fundamental solutions and strategies are critical and core to anything that you want to build after that or build on top of, right? I see where companies want to get these sophisticated tools, but they're not using MFA, or they're not, you know, doing some of the basics. They don't have visibility into their assets, right? They're not leveraging like zero trust. All of the things that we're saying are basic, foundational, are fundamental principles and solutions that should be in place in order to protect your organization. And so that would be what my billboard would say. And I think it's kind of ringing true right now when you think about, you know, Mythos and what's happening now around vulnerability management and what people need to do in order to protect their companies moving forward as these large language models continue to evolve over time.
No, that's facts. And like earlier when you were talking about, when you said be brilliant at the basics, I just reported that there's a ransom group targeting law firms because of their high profile. They know that they care about the reputation so much that if they get breached, they're 9 times out of 10 going to cave in because they don't want their clients to know their data isn't safe, and it'll hurt their business a lot. And the crazy thing is the way that they are breaching them is the simplest thing, with just manipulating help desk or using Teams to say, hey, I'm IT, click on this link, let me install something on your computer. Like simple stuff that they shouldn't be able to do.
That's what I'm saying. So now what happened is that all industries are on alert now, right? They have figured out who has the crown jewels, who has the critical information, how to get into companies without indirectly getting into them, right? Through their attorneys or other ways, through other third parties. They have found that this is more effective. And so as a result, organizations can't just care about their own organization. They have to care about the third, fourth, and fifth parties, because guess what? That's where they're going.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, guys, unfortunately, we're at the end of this. On Textual Talk, we'd like to get long-winded, but we work with the confines that we had. So I'm pretty sure that the listeners and the watchers, they're probably going to say, hey, when are you going to have her back on? But how do they connect with you or keep up with the things that you're working on? Or does it see your thoughts on LinkedIn or anywhere else?
Yeah, I would just say connect with me on LinkedIn, Nicole Darden Ford. You'll find me. I love to engage. I think I put out some really amazing thought leadership pieces for people to see what's going on in the industry and how they should be thinking about things. So that's the best way to connect with me. You can always just connect with me, say hello, ask me questions. I engage on LinkedIn quite often.
Perfect, perfect, guys. Appreciate you all for rocking with us today. Until next time, stay textual, and we're out. Peace.